that the DNC has been fueled by the grassroots over this past year. That's because that energy and momentum that is out there, they are giving directly to candidates, they're giving to other groups, but they're also giving to the DNC. We've seen an uptick in grassroots fundraising. That's gifts under $200 amount throughout the whole year. It's really what's sustained us. But look, when you lose an election in 2016 like we did, and you lose all over the country over the previous years, there is some disappointment that's still out there. And some of our largest supporters, you know, we've got to rebuild trust. And that's the work that Chairman Perez, myself, and others have been doing over this past year. We promised those donors, look, this year, we're going to do four things. We're going to rebuild. We're going to organize everywhere and early. We're going to work on our modernizing our data and technology, and we're going to win. We did all four of those things, and I think that's why you see a surge in the last few months of this year, because we're doing exactly what we said we needed to do to win.
I just want to play a little bit of tape of, if I can. Democrats, I mean, have long complained about the lack of efficiency at the DNC, and here's a clip from a Democrat who ought to know. It's Hillary Clinton. She was addressing a Silicon Valley conference last spring.
I inherit nothing from the Democratic Party.
What do you mean nothing?
I mean, it was bankrupt. It was on the verge of insolvency. Its data was mediocre to poor, non-existent, wrong.
If those criticisms are fair, what can you tell Democrats that you are doing right now to fix these problems in time for midterms that are about to get really cranking?
Yeah, there's two things that we're focused on that are really important. One is rebuilding on the organizing side. We are organizing early and often and everywhere through every zip code counts, which is basically through all 50 states, and investing in these state parties that can build campaigns. What Hillary Clinton had to do was have robust operations all over the country and campaign offices all over the country. That's something that the national party ought to be doing through our state parties right now and early, not just for 2018, but in preparation for 2020. The second thing that she's talking about is the data and technology. The RNC made a significant investment in 2013 after losing to Barack Obama twice. They made over $100 million investment in data technology to make it better. We've got to do the same thing, and that's why we need donors and everyone to continue to support the DNC for the infrastructure that we'll need to win now and in the future.
Jess O'Connell is the CEO of the Democratic National Committee. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Three large U.S. cities are suing the Department of Defense. Here's why. They say the military is not complying with a law that requires it to report service members with criminal histories to the FBI. They say this kind of reporting would prevent crimes like last month's mass shooting in a church in Texas. Now, the shooter, Devin Kelly, was convicted of assaulting family members in a 2012 court-martial. No one ever reported that to the National Background Check System, so no one stopped him from buying the rifle, which he used to kill 26 people. Kenneth Tabor is an attorney. He's representing the cities of New York, Philadelphia, and San Francisco, and he's on the line with us from New York. Good morning, Kenneth.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you. How widespread is the problem of service members' criminal histories not being reported?
Well, it turns out that the Kelly case is just the tip of the iceberg. We now know from reports from the Inspector General of the Department of Defense himself that this is a problem that goes back 20 years and involves thousands upon thousands of instances in which reports that should have been made weren't.
Okay, if it's a law that the military has to report service members with criminal histories to the FBI, why is the military not just following the law?
That's a very good question, and our litigation will very much try to get to the bottom of that. We know that the Inspector General testified to the Senate about 3 weeks ago that he thought the problem was that the recommendations that have been coming from his office for two decades were simply not taken seriously enough. Pretty astonishing.
But
that was the testimony.
There was, of course, the horrific shooting in the church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. And I wonder, are there other cases of gun violence that can be traced back to a failure to report?
Almost certainly the answer is yes, but we don't know that because it's not the kind of thing that gets followed up. But regrettably, we've become inured to the notion of individual violence. There could be who knows how many instances of individual violence that never get reported, that never garner media attention, and that involve exactly the same fact pattern. We just don't know.
The cities that are suing, New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco, I'm curious, why those three? Why not a place like Sutherland Springs, Texas, which was directly impacted by this failure to report? Did you try to get Sutherland Springs on board?
We didn't, and it's because the real issue here is not where the prior church shooting occurred. It's where the harm from the gap in this system, the serious gap in this system, is being felt. And where it's being felt are in the major U.S. cities that every day go into that FBI background check system in order to determine whether to issue permits, whether to allow gun transactions to go forward, whether to return guns to people involved in instances of domestic violence. They are the people who every day suffer the harm of this grossly incomplete and inaccurate system.
So what are you hoping this lawsuit achieves?
Well, we're hoping that the defendants will agree with us that this is a serious problem that needs to be addressed by the courts with judicial supervision and a judicially crafted solution.
All right, so that there needs to be oversight, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. We've had two decades without oversight, and the results are clear. The system has failed.
Attorney Kenneth Tabor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Attorney Kenneth Tabor is a partner with Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman. NPR asked the Department of Defense for comment. They referred us to the Department of Justice. The DOJ declined to comment.
All right. In Kabul, a suicide bomber has targeted a Shiite cultural center and news agency. The Afghan Interior Ministry is saying more than 40 people were killed and dozens were wounded this morning. NPR's Dia Hadid has been following this news from Islamabad.
Live television showed ambulances rushing to Kabul's Istiqlal Hospital as relatives milled outside. The suicide bomber targeted the Taiban Center just as a morning discussion panel was underway in the basement. A local reporter identified at least two men killed in the attack. One was a journalist. Another had just celebrated his university graduation. There were conflicting reports of how many explosions took place and how many attackers were involved, and nobody has claimed responsibility so far. A Taliban spokesman issued a statement saying they didn't do it, and the apparent target of the attack, Shiites, suggests it may have been undertaken by Islamic State militants. Since they emerged 2 years ago in Afghanistan, they have relentlessly targeted Shiites. They see them as heretics. The US, the UN, the Afghan presidency, and NATO quickly condemned the attack. But the human rights group Amnesty International said condemnations weren't enough. They said the attack showed that the international community, particularly Europe, needed to stop forcibly returning Afghan asylum seekers back home. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
This is NPR News.
And on this very chilly Thursday morning, it is 8:18, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll bring you NPR headlines next, and after that, during the WPR newscast, a longtime politician and broadcaster from northern Wisconsin is retiring at the age of 94. Find out more about him from WPR's Glenn Moberg in a few minutes during the statewide newscast.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Pleasant Prairie's RecPlex hosts a New Year's Eve celebration from 5 to 8 p.m., including dinner, games, open swim, open skate, live music, and more. Cost of admission is $15 per person. Register at recplexonline.com.
Impact on the community. WPR is pleased to promote live theater. More information at wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. In Alabama, Republican Roy Moore has filed a lawsuit to try to prevent state officials from certifying Democrat Doug Jones as the winner of this month's special Senate election. They're supposed to do that later today. Kyle Gassett with Troy Public Radio says Moore is alleging voter fraud.
Moore claims that the Secretary of State of Alabama has ignored irregularities that occurred at some polling places, including attempts to submit pre-marked ballots for Jones and instances of individuals from out of state being allowed to vote. Moore also says that the results of a polygraph test show that the allegations of sexual misconduct made against him are false.
Jones defeated Moore by about 20,000 votes. Forecasters say extreme cold will keep its grip on the northern U.S. through the weekend. Temperatures are below zero again this morning in parts of the upper Midwest and northern New England. It's minus six in Bangor, Maine. Winter storm watches are posted in northern Idaho and much of Montana. Meteorologist Mark Chouinard with the National Weather Service says there are a few areas where it's warm right now.
Southern California, southern Arizona, southern Florida. Those look to be the three areas that are still seeing nice temperatures, 70s to around 80.
The Labor Department says new claims for unemployment benefits in the U.S. held steady last week. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A former Wisconsin lawmaker and Hall of Fame broadcaster is retiring from politics at the age of 94. As Glenn Moberg reports, Republican Walter John Chilson served for 24 years in the state Senate.
Chilson was a senator from 1966 to 1990. He's retiring after serving 17 additional years on the Town of Weston Board of Supervisors. At 94, he's not afraid to criticize his own Republican Party.
The big complaints right now against the Republicans is that showing too much favoritism to the ultra-wealthy. And it may be true. I don't know why the ultra-wealthy couldn't be taxed much more heavily.
Chilson said he would not want to serve in state or national politics today.
People say, Walter John, we need you down in the state Senate again. And I say, no way. I don't want to be down there at all with the kind of viciousness that's going on right now.
In the 50s, Walter John Chilson was the first news director and anchor at WSAU-TV when it was the only station in Wausau. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Governor Scott Walker's administration says the typical family of four in Wisconsin will see about a $2,500 tax cut under the recently passed Republican tax overhaul. Walker released details yesterday of the analysis completed by the State Department of Revenue. Using census data and expected growth, the median income for a Wisconsin family of four next year is projected to be around $94,000. Multiple analyses of the law have found that middle-class tax cuts will gradually fade and morph into a tax hike.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed.com, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, then review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, Pew's new podcast, After the Fact, tells stories behind the data with analysis of today's policy issues. More information is available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From Care.com, offering home pay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. UNICEF has just released an end-of-year statement full of really devastating statistics about children in conflict zones. Here are a few of them. 11 million kids in Yemen need humanitarian assistance. Almost 700 children were killed in Afghanistan in the first 9 months of this year. In Nigeria, Boko Haram has forced kids to act as suicide bombers. I asked UNICEF USA CEO Carol Stern what concerns her most as we head into a new year.
Obviously, the Syrian refugee crisis is huge, you know, and the idea of what's going on in Yemen right now, the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar, all of it with 50 million kids on the move, 28 million of them forcibly removed from their homes. These are staggering numbers, and the world is not yet prepared for what to do with them.
When you try to wrap your mind around the scale of these numbers, how do you narrow this down so that this suffering doesn't just become millions upon millions upon millions of faceless children?
You know, it's really hard for us to get our arms around numbers that big. And so I try to tell the story of what it means for a child to be recruited and forced into either slavery or trafficking or recruited into armed forces at a very young age. You know, kids are being used as human shields. They're trapped under siege. We keep seeing that on the news everywhere, targeted by snipers. And this is what these kids are living with every single day.
You've been in charge of the U.S. arm of UNICEF for the last 10 years. Do you think the norms around children in combat have changed? Is it less likely for children to be identified as civilians, as people that you don't touch, you don't hurt them?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think the world is more aware today that children are being recruited. You know, I think we were shocked when we first saw that. It's like disasters. You know, you always say after a little while, the disasters don't sound as bad because you hear so many of them.
Yeah.
So has the situation grown? It absolutely has. There are more kids being recruited than ever before. And I think our tolerance for it is that we're less shocked. I don't think we accept it as okay, but we're less shocked by it, which makes our jobs that much harder.
Are you worried about the Trump administration saying that the United States should change its relationship to the United Nations? Are you worried about some of the talk around cuts to aid for particular countries?
I am extremely worried about cuts to aid. You know, any time that we deny a child a childhood, I'm worried, as we all should be, because we shouldn't be defining children by their borders. We should be defining them by their age, and it is no less horrific for a child born in Yemen or Syria or Myanmar or Texas this year or Florida. Any child being denied a childhood is an immoral situation for me. And I really believe that we as a people need to stand up for children.
Is there anything in the coming year in 2018 that you're really hoping to see, that you think in light of these staggering numbers and in light of so much despair, is there something in 2018 that you are looking forward to that you think might get better?
I'm really hoping that as Americans, we can begin to put children first. You know, there was a huge celebration on November 20th of World Children's Day. And one of the things that came out of it that I thought was really interesting is an artist, and I can't think of the artist's name, did a statue, which was a replica of a desk in the General Assembly, but made for a child, and asked that it be put on the General Assembly floor so as world leaders make decisions, they will consider their impact on children. If I have a goal for this year, it's let's get that desk in every place, every decision room. Let's all start to think about, as I consider my product, as I consider my government policy, my immigration laws, etc., can we all come to some agreement about putting children in our minds as we make those decisions?
Carol Stern is the CEO of UNICEF USA. Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Noel.
In Mexico, consumers are feeling the pinch as the national currency continues to struggle against the dollar. The central bank tried to shore up the peso this week, but the currency failed to rally. Worries over inflation at home and stalled renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement have been dogging Mexico's economy all year. But as NPR's Kerry Khan reports, the latest blow to the peso came with the passage of President Trump's tax bill.
The fear south of the border is that with corporate taxes lower in the U.S., Mexico won't look as attractive to businesses. A possible drop in foreign investment here sent the peso tumbling this week to its lowest level in nearly 10 months. Mexico's central bank tried to perk up the peso by selling off an additional $500 million in a foreign currency auction. The tactic usually gives the peso a boost, but there was no such rally this time. Rosa Maria Ravilla stands outside an ATM near downtown Mexico City, where the exchange rate on the door has the peso hovering close to 20 to the dollar. She says everything has gone up.
La alimento básico, ¿no? El arroz está muy caro, frijol.
Basic food stuff like rice and beans, she says, not to mention natural gas, which she says has skyrocketed in the last 2 months. Mexico imports natural gas from the U.S. to the tune of nearly $4 billion a year.
Y no sé qué vamos a hacer.
Who knows what we're going to do, she chuckles, trying to stay upbeat. Down the street, 27-year-old educator Ricardo Lozano doesn't try and hide his pessimism. He says he thinks 2018 won't be that happy of a new year.
Pues siempre tengo esperanzas de algo mejor, pero la realidad...
I try and have hope, but the way things are going, it doesn't look good, he says. Economists here tend to agree. They say a whole host of factors will fall hard on Mexico next year. Inflation is expected to continue rising, and uncertainty next year over negotiations of the North American Free Trade Agreement and Mexico's own presidential elections will increase pressure on the peso. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Mexico City.
And I have the pleasure of hosting the show this week with Noel King from Planet Money. It's been fun having you here.
Thanks, David.
And people can find you on Twitter by going to...
at Noel E. King.
All right, there it is. I am at NPR Green. Steve is at NPR Inskeep. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR. And you can find all of our staff and their Twitter handles if you go to the NPR website, npr.org, click on Programs, Morning Edition, and Staff. They are the people who do the real hard work, and you can watch what they're up to on social media. We encourage you to do that. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
People in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, used to protest daily against President Nicolas Maduro, whom many consider a dictator. A violent crackdown and severe food shortages have put an end to that.
It's like this thing that we believed before, that we were able to make a change. Now, I don't feel I can make a change.
A Venezuelan protester's story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR, and coming up this hour still, this Sunday marks the 50th anniversary of the storied Ice Bowl. It still holds the title of the all-time coldest NFL game in the league's history. Look back on that famed Packers and Cowboys game in 15 minutes. Good morning, it's 8:30. I'm Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin Public Radio News, Wisconsin Republican Congressman Glenn Grothman says President Trump should be commended for improving the nation's business climate in 2017. Grothman says a surging stock market shows that investors think the economy will continue to grow. But in a year-end interview with Wisconsin Public Radio, Grothman says Trump's Twitter habit has hurt him.
I wish you wouldn't tweet so much, and I think that hurts him. Otherwise, I think he inherited quite a few problems. He's taken off and trying to deal with those problems. I think he wrapped things up with the tax cut, which is good.
Grothman says he hopes Congress can pass major changes to the nation's welfare programs in 2018. He says he also expects a bipartisan health care bill to emerge in the next few months. A state appeals court says a woman convicted of snatching purses from the Oneida Casino and the Brown County Courthouse was properly sentenced. Prosecutors accused Atavia Price in 2015 of pepper spraying a casino patron and stealing her purse, as well as one from a courthouse. She was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison. Price argued on appeal that her sentence was excessive. A district court of appeals disagreed. This is WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Cold day today in Wisconsin. Temperatures are hovering slightly above zero this morning, and with the wind chill, it'll feel even colder. Expect anywhere from 0.5 inch to 2 inches of snow throughout the state today.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform, committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Next month, lawmakers are going to start looking for ways to pay for the tax bill they just passed. House Speaker Paul Ryan wants to overhaul federal entitlement programs. He says they cost too much and they make people dependent. Medicaid is one of the programs under review. More than 70 million Americans are enrolled. So I called up Carolyn Pearson. She's a senior vice president of Avalere Health, which advises companies on health care policy. And I asked her, who exactly is enrolled in Medicaid?
I would think about them in three main groups. The biggest group, about half of the program, is actually low-income children. Medicaid pays for about half of the births in this country, so that's the biggest cohort.
Wow.
The other two groups are seniors and people with disabilities. So Medicaid actually pays for the costs of coverage for about 1 in 5 Medicare beneficiaries, our nation's seniors, as well as people who have very serious health conditions. And then the last group is other low-income adults who simply can't afford other sources of insurance.
All right. With any entitlement program, there are always going to be complaints that the people on it should go out and get jobs, they should work, they're abusing the system. Is there evidence that a lot of people are, quote-unquote, taking advantage of Medicaid?
That's not the case. In fact, most of the research suggests people who are able to be working and are on Medicaid are doing so. And the people who are on Medicaid and not working generally aren't able to do so either because they're kids or, as I said, they've got disabilities and aren't in a health state where they can really go to work on a daily basis.
Okay, so a lot at stake for people here. And I wonder if there are cuts to Medicaid, could recipients just get subsidized insurance through Obamacare?
Unfortunately, no. Medicaid is really the safety net system that we have for the lowest income Americans. Obamacare doesn't cover anyone below the poverty level. So for our poorest individuals in the country, Medicaid is really the only option.
Have you had any conversations of note with either hospitals or insurance providers? Are people concerned that this is really something that might happen, or is it like, nah, this is just politics?
Hospitals and other healthcare providers are some of the most concerned stakeholders about Medicaid. They are the people that have to provide coverage when sick people show up in their emergency rooms. And so they would much rather get paid in a rational way and be able to take good care of those people throughout the year, not just when they are very sick. And then the health insurers certainly want to get more people buying into the system on a regular basis rather than just paying for them in emergency situations only.
And what are your clients telling you?
Well, I think Medicaid survived some big hits this year. The Affordable Care Act repeal and replace efforts tried to remove big chunks of Medicaid, and that was one of the things that really brought those bills down. But I think next year's efforts are really going to turn to trying to control spending. So the question is, can you cover very sick populations and very needy populations for less money? And I think that's something we're going to need to wrestle with in 2018.
What are you keeping an eye on in this week and in the week ahead?
Well, we're looking at how Congress is going to move forward with efforts on entitlement reform, and then what role the states are going to play. The states are co-funders of this program, and so the governors tend to have a strong voice in saying what is feasible in terms of reforming Medicaid and what isn't.
Because they'd be picking up the slack. If Medicaid nationally is cut, it will be states that pay for it.
Right. When the federal government cuts its spending, states are left holding the bag, and so the governors get very worried about that situation.
Carolyn Pearson is a senior vice president of Avalere Health. We spoke to her via Skype. Carolyn, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
A personal shopping service. It's the sort of thing that's been associated with the wealthy elite and luxury brands. Certainly not a company like Walmart, at least until now. Here's NPR's Alina Selyuk.
Jessica Leila Adnani runs a business called Personalized Solutions. It basically helps busy, wealthy people get stuff done.
Personal shopping, lifestyle management, estate management, travel planning, you name it.
It's called a concierge service. And I asked Adnani to meet me at an upscale retail center in downtown Washington because I want to talk about personal shopping, which is a big part of her job.
Sometimes you're just hired to make sure that they have 15 different dresses for gala season, or maybe they're going on a really big trip to Italy and they need you to purchase outfits and then pack them.
One person hired her to close on a new condo and quickly furnish it. There was a lot of Christmas gift buying. I asked Adnani where she normally goes to shop.
My favorite designers, if we're talking clothing, would definitely be Emilio Pucci. I also enjoy Salvatore Ferragamo.
Which is, I think, just down from
right
here.
Right down here, exactly.
For home goods, she offers other brands on the higher end. But then she says less expensive retail stores also have their moments, which gives me a chance to bring up a specific one. Have you ever run into Walmart for any of your purchases?
I have actually never been into Walmart for anything client related.
And Walmart really wants to change that. The company is known for its low prices, but now, trying to remain the world's largest retailer, Walmart is branching out. Its latest test is a personal shopping service. The company doesn't divulge any details, but it has posted jobs that describe a personalized concierge for everyday shopping. They're calling the project Code 8. News site Recode reports that the target audience is high net worth urban consumers. I tell Adnani all this, and she looks extremely surprised.
I think that the biggest problem they're going to face with this is the high net worth shopper is not a Walmart shopper.
Which is exactly the point. Walmart is searching for new growth avenues. It's been testing new services, like delivering groceries with an option to put them directly into your fridge if you're not home. And it's been buying other retailers, online menswear site Bonobos and an indie clothing store, ModCloth, both of which had younger and very loyal customers.
One of the reasons why I have loved ModCloth is because it's a place where I can buy size extra small all the way up to 4X.
Cora PV Alvilar is a beauty and fashion blogger with hundreds of thousands of followers. She focuses a lot on plus size fashion, and ModCloth used to make frequent appearances on her YouTube channel, Vintage or Tacky. But the sale to Walmart really riled her.
My very first reaction was, you know, has the world gone upside down? Here was this company that stood for all these amazing ethics and this independent spirit. And then they sold themselves to Walmart, which is like the ultimate corporate retailer that has been known to have unscrupulous business practices.
This is an image that Walmart would dispute, but it's the result of decades of worker lawsuits and allegations from advocacy groups. Analysts say it's a reputation that Walmart needs to shake to get that new, cool X factor. Alvilar says she's not boycotting Walmart, and she understands that for many people it's the only affordable or available option. But now Walmart is going hard after people with many options and a lot of money. Both Alvilar and Adnani say they're skeptical, though curious, to see if the strategy works. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for starting your day with us. Coming up next, it's headlines. Those are coming live from NPR and WPR. And that's followed by we're talking about the Ice Bowl that happened here in Wisconsin. And it's the 50th anniversary this weekend. Don't miss that story.
Thanks to listener support, 2017 has been a big year at WPR. We've created new programs, mentored young reporters, and celebrated a remarkable milestone as the first public radio station in the nation. 2018 promises another year of insightful news, world-class music, and fascinating discussions, all possible thanks to your support. Make your year-end gift right now at WPR.org. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. ISIS says it was behind today's suicide bombings at a Shiite Muslim cultural center in Afghanistan's capital. NPR's Dia Hadid says more than 40 people were killed and dozens wounded.
Local media reported that there were two suicide bombers. One of them detonated his explosives at the gate of a Shiite cultural center. The blast also damaged an Iranian-owned news agency. The militant group Islamic State has repeatedly attacked Shiites in the past.
Afghan officials say many of the victims were students attending a conference at the center. The country's president and the U.S. Embassy in Kabul are condemning the attack. Britain is bracing for its coldest night of the year. Snow is forecast for parts of northern England. The National Weather Service says the extreme cold gripping the northern U.S. will last through the weekend. It's below zero this morning in parts of the upper Midwest and northern New England. In New York City, they're preparing for a very cold New Year's Eve celebration in Times Square.
One of the factors that affects whether we get an overflow crowd or a regular, very, very crowded crowd is the weather. So if it's a little bit colder, there will be perhaps a little fewer people, but we will always have a full house.
That's Tim Tompkins with the Times Square Alliance. Temperatures in New York City are expected to be in the low teens on Sunday night. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Madison's bike sharing program has recorded its highest annual ride total since it began in 2011. This year, Madison B-Cycle has logged more than 110,000 rides. The company has 44 stations and 350 bicycles in the city. Morgan Raymaker is the executive director of Madison B-Cycle. She says one of the factors driving growth was the addition of 6 new bike stations in the State Street and Capitol areas, which are popular with visitors.
Places where people are, and we just had a little bit of a gap for B-Cycle stations, and we really felt like that could drive great trips, having that be such a dense area and really the heart of Madison.
Milwaukee's Bubbler Bikes had about 91,000 rides this year. That's up 30% from last year. Conservationists in Wisconsin say they've spotted a record number of nests from the endangered Kirtland's warbler this year, a decade after the songbird was first spotted in the state. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that 15 nests have been found so far in Wisconsin. However, thousands of Kirtland's warblers are in neighboring Michigan, where habitat restoration has been underway for 40 years. The birds are particular about where they nest. That contributes to the uncertainty about their stay in Wisconsin. The birds were first discovered in Wisconsin in the central part of the state, but state and federal officials are now focusing on counties where the birds have been spotted in the northern part of Wisconsin. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox Insurance, providing customized insurance for small and medium businesses so they can do more and be more. Learn more at HISCOX.com or from an agent. Hiscox Insurance. Encourage courage. From LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform, committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at RWJF.org.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. This New Year's Eve marks the 50th anniversary of the storied Ice Bowl. It still holds the title for the all-time coldest NFL game in the league's history. The Green Bay Packers beat the Dallas Cowboys in the final moments of the game at Lambeau Field. The game had it all action-wise, but it was sub-zero temperature-wise. Patty Murray reports.
Sportscaster Ray Scott summed it up before game time on December 31st, 1967.
And by any yardstick, it's just plain cold. It is indeed cold in Green Bay.
The roughly 58,000 fans at Lambeau Field that day do remember the searing cold, but Packer team historian Cliff Crystal says he and the others all stuck around because of the compelling action.
Well, the weather obviously is what made it different. I mean, a lot of NFL games have been won in the final seconds.
The Packers met the Dallas Cowboys for what was then the NFL Championship, which Crystal says at the time was a bigger deal than the fledgling Super Bowl.
They beat Dallas on a quarterback sneak by Bart Starr with 13 seconds remaining in the game. Just a legendary drive under the conditions.
That sneak gave the Packers a 21-17 win over Dallas. It would be the Packers' third straight NFL championship title, something Crystal says has yet to be repeated to this day. Despite the on-field action, it's the weather that made the Ice Bowl go down in history. Gene Brusky is the science and operations officer for the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Like so many other Green Bay natives, he has an Ice Bowl connection. His father was the team doctor who ended up treating players and referees for frostbite. Brusky says December 1967 started out mild.
In the first half of December, we had sort of this split flow, and that basically kept the air bottled up in Canada, and we were more under the influence of a subtropical jet, which kept us milder. During the second half of December, and as we approached basically the last 12 days of the month, that's where we got into that, what we refer to, if you want to use football jargon, a second half adjustment.
By the morning of the 31st, forecasts predicted cold temperatures, but not to the point of 16 below, which was where the mercury was during game time. The cold prompted older ticket holders to offer seats to younger folks, like Dave Hansen, who now represents Green Bay in the state Senate.
I didn't go out searching for tickets the day before, but when the neighbor came up with them, and at that time, when you're 20 years old with not a lot of money, 12 bucks seemed reasonable. But when my mother said, you can't go, it's too cold, I'm saying, hey, $12 is $12.
So Hansen bundled up and sat down on the cold aluminum bleachers to watch the team. He has a dog-eared Ice Bowl program to prove he was actually at the game that some consider to be the Woodstock of football. That's to say, if everyone who claims to have been there actually was.
December 31st, 1967, a million people said they were there, but I was there.
Packer historian Cliff Crystal is willing to cut people some slack.
When people tell me they were at the Ice Bowl, I believe them.
Crystal says back then, almost the entire city population could have fit into the stadium. So chances are anyone in Green Bay 50 years ago had a good chance of being at the Ice Bowl. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Bart Starr of the Green Bay Packers. Go, you Packers, go!
It's 9 minutes before, or it's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Don't go anywhere. Coming up next on Morning Edition, Vanna White of Wheel of Fortune fame has been turning letters on the game show for 35 years. Just ahead, she tells David Green that while her job may seem silly, you can't solve a puzzle if she doesn't turn the letters. Don't miss that story next here on Morning Edition.
WPR's old-time radio drama is coming to Wausau. Hi, I'm Norman Gilliland. Join me and the 9XM Players for a family-friendly performance of Oscar Wilde's Canterville Ghost at UW Marathon County on February 9th. Experience the golden age of radio with period costumes, sound effects, live music, and more. Find details at wpr.org/ghost.
Bitter cold temperatures will continue through the state today. The temperatures are hovering below or just above 0 degrees this morning. Remember that the wind chill will once again make it feel even colder today. There will be periods of flurries and light fluffy snow. Anywhere from 0.5 inch to 2 inches of accumulations are possible.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, devoted to keeping higher education accessible through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More information is at supportuw.org.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. And Noelle, I've got a kind of funny way to introduce our next guest.
Okay.
The category is game show host.
Game show host?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to buy a vowel?
Oh, Wheel of Fortune. All right, so if the category is game show host, it's got to be Pat Sajak or Vanna White.
You got it. It's actually Vanna. I went to meet her at the Wheel of Fortune studios recently in Culver City, California.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
David Green.
Hey, David. I'm Vanna.
It's so nice to meet you. It's surreal to meet you. I've watched you for so long. It has actually been 35 years I've been watching the show, and that's how long Vanna has been doing it.
So where are we? Is this your dressing room? My dressing room. Welcome. Thank you. Yes. How long have you been using this dressing room? A long time. That little room over there, which is now my office, used to be my son's nursery, and he's 23. Does that say it
that
all?
That gives us a sense for the longevity. And so I'm looking at a lot of outfits. You honestly have never worn the same outfit on two shows, is that?
That is correct.
That's extraordinary.
And I've worn over 6,500 gowns. 6,500, never the same one twice.
6,500 shows. I mean, it's amazing to think about how much the world has changed, even as Vanna White has been doing the exact same job, turning those letters. No doubt she is one of the most recognizable faces in American entertainment, and we thought her 35-year anniversary was a good time to reflect back with her. Vanna White, who was born in South Carolina, took us back to a difficult decision she made shortly after moving west to look for acting work.
When I first moved to Los Angeles, I came out here with $1,000 to my name. I immediately got a job. I got an apartment. I was barely surviving, but I was too embarrassed to ask my dad for rent money, so I did some lingerie shots. Fast forward many years later, I become famous. So Hugh Hefner buys these pictures and decides to put them on the cover of Playboy and inside Playboy. And my career was just starting on Wheel of Fortune. And I went to him because he was a personal friend. And I said, Hef, if you do this, this could ruin my career. Please, you're my friend. You can stop this from happening. Please don't do that to me. And he did it. And it really hurt my feelings more than anything. There's nothing I could do about it because I did the shots. But when I was taking those shots with the photographer, I knew it was not right. Fortunately, America was behind me. And I went on Johnny Carson and explained the situation. And Sony didn't fire me, thank goodness, because they could have. You know, here's my whatever on the cover of Playboy. And they were, again, the fans and everyone were supportive on that. But it was a great lesson.
So what makes this show so enduring? I mean, my summers were every afternoon, I mean, being on the beach and then coming in and sitting on the edge of my grandmother's bed and watching you.
I think you've said it all right there with saying your grandma, because it's a family show. It's 30 minutes when you're spending time with your family. You're solving the puzzles together. You're just being together. There's so much horrible stuff going on in the world right now. To have 30 minutes of quality time with a family member is special.
Let me ask you this, Vanna White. The roles of women over 35 years have changed a lot. You see women in roles that you never saw before, and a lot of people see that as progress. It's part of a movement. Where do you fit in to that, doing this job, you know, through all those years?
It's funny because my job has not really changed in all these years. And Merv Griffin, whatever he saw 35 years ago in this little game show, has been around for a long, long time. I think it's part of it's a cult almost, right?
What's really complicated for me to work through, and I really want to hear you talk about, is the, you know, a lot of women would say the example we want to see is women who are in roles that men usually play that are not stereotypical, things like that. And you know, your relationship with Pat Sajak, it's very, you know, he's sort of the male host, and you're up there.
Sure. I think what you're saying, in this world, men seem to have more of an advantage. And in my particular situation of my job, oh, I'm just a letter turner. I'm up there, you know, turning letters. So what does that mean? It means I feel that I'm just as equal as Pat, even though he is the host of the show. I'm the co-host. That doesn't make me any smaller than him or any bigger than him. I feel that the way America has put us together as a team has made us equal. And I will be the first to make fun of my job. I turn letters for a living, really. In the beginning, I was put down quite a bit for that, but I've made the best of my job. I love my job. I've turned it into, I think, a different kind of job. Hey, you can't solve the puzzle if I don't turn the letter. So they need me there. And I don't think of it as anything negative or less than Pat's job. We're a team.
I was reading some of the early criticism. I mean, words like bimbo and robotic.
Yes.
How much did that hurt?
In the beginning, it did, because I felt invisible. I felt, what do these people think of me? It made me feel like I'm not a human being. So, again, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. And I think that I just maybe proved them wrong, because even though I hardly talk on the show and I just turn letters, I will say I am a businesswoman. So I've taken my job, and which has given me the chance to be in the public eye and have a name for myself, and I have turned that into other things. I have my own line of yarn. I mean, if I wasn't on TV, I wouldn't have that. So yes, I do this silly little job on the show, but I have made something out of it.
Got this in pocket.
That was Vanna White. She is marking 35 years as the co-host of Wheel of Fortune.
I'm feeling mental. Gonna make you notice. Got motion, restored emotion. I've been diving, detailed leaning. No reason, just seems so pleasing.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Noel King.
And remember that you can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9 weekdays here on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you want to follow news throughout the day, go online to our website. That's WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR.
Support for WPR comes from Titletown Brewing Company in Green Bay, now offering a variety of bottled beers throughout Wisconsin. More about their beers, historic facilities, and newly renovated brewery is at TitletownBrewing.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, with homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches being served daily at their historic soda fountain. Stop by Jack Andrea today for lunch and an old-fashioned soda. JackAndrea.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD.